guess I'll start now. This is my first time doing a presentation like this ever. And I only say that I'm gonna be using language that frankly does not sound very theoretical. I'm gonna be using very sort of simple language. That's the way that I best express myself. Basically, I'm going to talk about, my name is Andre, hi, and I'm going to talk about animism and how it relates to anarchism, but that how it relates to anarchism is going to come at the end, and it's not going to take up as much of the talk. What I'm going to do is focus more on giving a clear definition with examples and really explaining what animism is, because I think that our understanding of it will lead to links to anarchism, and maybe something that we can discuss at the end if you can think of some things that I don't mention. That being said, I will give some explicit examples at the end, and you can tell me what you think about them. I'm gonna start by saying, you know, we do have a lot of examples historically of societies that are more egalitarian than our own in history or presently. And I will say that just to avoid being called a romanticizer by the end of this talk, I would say that not all indigenous societies are egalitarian. I mean, there are very hierarchical indigenous societies as well, the Aztecs and the Mayas and the Incas, these sorts of societies. But almost all stable, long-term egalitarian societies are indigenous. There are instances of other societies that are more egalitarian than our own, that don't have structured hierarchies, that lasted for shorter periods of time. But I mean, talking about long term. And I think something that's interesting to me is that we, in Western culture, a lot of times, in its various forms, tries to emulate or incorporate specific aspects of these cultures into itself. First people started with this, you know, when they first started listening to indigenous people, I'm thinking particularly of Native North Americans, there was this idea of, well, they respect the earth, you know, and there's this, you know, that bumper sticker that you see everywhere, which is, says something like, we, you know, the earth does not belong to us, we belong to the earth, that kind of thing was appropriated. And then after that, I think sustainability was an idea that was, was really clung onto, and as anarchists, we have the example of John Zierzan, who talks about hunter-gatherer and how we need to go back to that and reincorporate that aspect into our society. And I think, unfortunately for us, indigenous societies aren't spice racks, you know? We can't just take the one thing that we like and pepper our culture with it, you know, and hope that that's gonna solve things. So, in other words, I mean, we can't be Unitarian Universalists about this. Like, we don't get to all be winners just because we take the things that we want and leave everything else. We have to understand that the thing that allows certain societies to be more egalitarian, I believe, is a difference in the structure of consciousness and perception, and a difference in the perception of consciousness as well. So I'm going to be talking about consciousness quite a bit. It's interesting, there is a string, even though these societies are wildly different in practice, there's a string through all these societies that I've noticed that have stable instances of decentralized power, of non-rigid hierarchies, a lack of emphasis on private property, and no or very small-scale human-to-human violence. And that string is animism, which is what I'm here to talk about. I think we're lucky as anarchists, we have a tremendous head start in that. I mean, I think the people in this room, at least, know the value of community. So I don't have to go into why community is valuable here. I don't have to talk about that. I hope not. Maybe you have questions about that at the end. But I think we understand how it's valuable. And animism exists mostly in a community context. And it's something that at once keeps communities together and also is itself reinforced by community. So I think we're really lucky to understand the importance of one of these aspects of more egalitarian societies. And I'm gonna talk about this other one, this difference in structure of perception. So I'm gonna talk about what animism is and isn't. I don't know if you all it's very funny. I hate when people use exclusionary language when they're talking about things. So I've been to a lot of presentations where people are talking about like rhizomal spread and like all that kind of shit, which I don't really understand, frankly. I mean, I do understand it, but it was a lot of language that I didn't quite, I had no idea what people were talking about. So I made this description and I thought for the thing and for the brochure or whatever, and I thought everybody would know what I was talking about, but then someone pointed out to me yesterday that it was completely vague and nobody, and that he didn't know what animism was at all, and so I was being exclusionary in that as well. So I fucked up. But I think, I mean, do you all maybe have a vague idea of what animism is, or have you, no? Okay, it's fine, because I'm going to go over it, but yeah.
It would be helpful if you gave sort of like a dictionary description.
That's what I'm going to do.
Great.
And the dictionary, it's interesting because the dictionary description is what animism isn't. So I'm going to talk about,
that's good.
I'm going to talk about what animism isn't first. Basically, the idea that most people have of animism, if they have a vague idea, is handed to us by people like James Frazier, Joseph Campbell, people who are so-called experts on indigenous societies, but really didn't know that much about them, or at least it seems like they didn't know that much about them. Animism is, according to those sorts of thinkers, it's like, say there's a rock, and a person in an indigenous society of one sort or another sees a rock, and that rock is alive to them, okay? But what Frazier and Campbell and these people said, these thinkers said, is that that rock, the indigenous person believed that that rock was animated by a spirit, okay? So there was matter, and it was animated by a spirit. And that came really from this idea that there was a big difference, a big split between the body and the spirit, that these two things weren't intermeshed so much that they couldn't be disentangled. So that's the false definition, but it's also the accepted definition. It's not the definition that's accepted by people who are real animists, and it's not accepted by cultures that still have animist practices. It's not the way that it is. Animism is something that's dismissed by science. I think as anarchists, a lot of us have a tendency to defer to science without knowing it, unconsciously a lot of times, or things that are accepted through just in empiricism and matter. But science, one of the reasons science rejects it is because it says, well, there can't be consciousness in this rock. Like, consciousness exists in the brain. It's a product of the brain. Consciousness is created, stored in the brain. And, I mean, this really isn't that much different than monotheistic ideas either, that the spirit or the soul or consciousness is in the body, it's in the individual. Even though it's a little bit different, they both agree that consciousness, personality is housed just inside the human body. And first of all, we shouldn't accept this definition that science gives us. I'm just going to sort of debunk it now just to get it out of the way so we can move on and talk about it in a more perhaps accepting manner. The brain, there's no evidence, consequently, that the brain is the seat of consciousness or that the brain creates consciousness. There is evidence that the brain is related to it. And there are so many exceptions to this rule that the brain is where consciousness comes from. Do you all know what hydrocephalus is? Wet brain, water on the brain, have you heard of this?
No.
Okay, yeah, well, water on the brain, it's sort of a misnomer. It's not like there's water on somebody's brain. Their brain actually is liquid. They're walking around, and literally there's liquid sloshing around where their brain should be. They don't have brains. This is very fascinating and bizarre instance, and functioning perfectly normally. I mean, I might have hydrocephalus right now, even though. There are some effects sometimes, long-term, but not always. And there have also been lots of instances of people who have gotten autopsies and they've just had a sort of rind in their skull and have been living for years with this rind instead of a brain. A lot of times people get brain damage and they function normally with a few exceptions. I'm actually going to come back to that example of brain trauma later. But, and this is all documented in science journals.
Those people with rind in the brain, they still had some brain though, right? Or
yeah.
But these have a lot less.
But I mean, you know, I mean, if you think about how big our skulls are to house a brain, it's one of the largest brains in the animal kingdom, right? And we're talking about it being about this big,
right?
Shrinking and being dry, a dry matter instead of something that's being provided with blood. So I only state all this outright just to say that let's not defer to science when we talk about this, because science by its own standards about consciousness, which is really wrapped up in animism in the way I'm going to talk about it, is flawed by its own terms. So that being said, I'm going to give some some examples of animism so we can maybe come to a better definition. A lot of my examples come from this book from Columbia University Press, which is called Animism. And it's by Graham Harvey. It's a beautiful book. And first, Graham Harvey is talking about walking around Australia with this Aboriginal guide, Bob Randall, who's taking him around. And he's just sort of pointing out certain things in the landscape. And Bob Randall and Graham Harvey get to this place, these two mountains. And Bob Randall says, okay, and this is where the two giant dogs are fighting, and one giant dog's intestines are spilled across the ground. And Graham Harvey says, wow, that's really interesting. Like, you guys have a myth about this place. And Bob Randall says, what? No, this is where the two dogs are fighting, and the one dog's intestines are spilled out across the ground. And Graham Harvey says, oh, so that's how you view the landscape. That's how it was formed. And Bob Randall, you know, finally, he just said, no, there are two dogs right there. Don't you see them? Don't you see the intestines? And it wasn't a metaphor. Now, it's very interesting, and there was this sort of overlay for Bob Randall on top of the material that he saw. So that's one example, and we can come back to these, and you can ask me more questions about these as we go along. But another example is that the Anishinaabeg, who are often called the Ojibwe people, but they call themselves the Anishinaabeg, so that's what I say. They have belief in the thunderers, right? When there's a storm, the thunderers arrive. And the storm clouds are at once clouds. They're also at the same time sacred spirits. They're also at the same time giant birds. This is the belief, and this is the system of perception to deal with these clouds. And sometimes when the thunderers come, they'll send a bolt of lightning down and strike a rock at the foot of a tree. And then the rock will come into consciousness and come to life. And then people from the tribe can interact with the rock. They can not just talk to it, but talk with it. I don't exactly know what that means. I mean, I haven't had a conversation with a rock, but if we're to not dismiss this completely, you know, dismiss thousands of years of culture and just say it's ridiculous, there's something going on there. Then there's also Maori animism, something he talks about, the Maori people, where things are made alive by interaction through art, which is a really interesting phenomenon, where there'll be a space and the Maori people will erect walls around the space, and then the space inside those erected walls will come to life. It will be a living thing. Also, they will carve green stone, and when they carve the green stone, it takes on a new name. It's called the Paunamu. And the green stone that they carve will have a name, it will have a relationship to the wearer, and it'll have a gender, it'll have different features. So these stones are given a different form of life through the carving and the relation to the wearer. And if these examples seem completely alien to us, I think we can find examples of animism in our own lives pretty easily, if these examples seem too distant. Right? As a child, if you're walking through the room and you stub your toe, you look back at that table and you say, how could you do this to me? You know, I mean, you have this real sense of blame for that object. Right, so we do experience it as children. I think also if you're an academic or just someone who reads, what could be more animistic, I think, than reading a text? I mean, all the walls fall away and the narrative becomes something that's living. It takes on a property that's more than just like these symbols on the page. It has a very living property, an active quality. And also then the really obvious example that we're animistic with our pets. You know, we may talk to our animals, but, you know, even if we don't talk to a wasp that's touching the screen in our sun porch, we would talk to our dog and treat it differently, as if it's a person, as if it can understand us and tell us things and have a conversation. So this all points to something very peculiar if you begin to look at the similarities between these types of animism. And that is that animism and consciousness are really linked up. We don't have to discard completely that our brains are involved in consciousness to accept this. Henri Bergson, something he said, which I think is really beautiful, is that the brain doesn't create consciousness. It doesn't store memory. It's actually a receiver. So the world comes in and the brain limits what comes in. It doesn't actually create or hold it. And I think this is where brain trauma comes in again. There are plenty of cases. I have a friend also who has had severe brain trauma, where when you have brain trauma, my friend Mira, when she walks into a room after her car accident, if she would walk into a room, a cafe, where people were talking, she would hear all the conversations at once, and it was overwhelming, it was overload. It actually enhanced her senses. It didn't limit them anymore than they already were. And there are so many cases of this. Oliver Sacks talks about this too. So while there are all wild differences in how animism manifests itself, there's this one thing that's static, which is that animism manifests itself in a relationship between two things. And I think consciousness also does this. Let me just stop for a second and before I explain that statement, because I know it's a lot of information. I'm going over a lot of different fields of inquiry at once. But you know, when I like to do this when I'm talking to anybody, you know, you just have that moment where you have to stop and say, why does this matter, right? Because you can get so lost in the ideas that you're presenting, and why does this matter? And just to bring it back to the beginning, it matters because we're concerned about community and community's place in the world as anarchists, I think, or at least I am, as you know. And animism is something that can change the structure and the way that a community goes through the world and goes through life. And I'm going to come back to that, you know, again, but. So we're talking about relationships and how to see the world as a system of relationships down to the deepest level. So the examples I gave, there's interaction, there are relationships. There's a relationship with these mountains and a person, a man and a place. And another, it's a non-human, the thunderous and the rock, and another non-human. And still another, it's human action and non-human form, the carving of these stones, the erecting of these walls. And the cases we're more familiar with, it's a child and a table. It's an interaction. It's an interaction between a reader and a text. It's an interaction between a person and their pet. And what I want to say is that maybe we can begin to understand consciousness and through animism by saying that consciousness is something that emerges through an interaction between two things. It's not located in one place. It's something that comes through relationship. So to understand this, I'm going to turn to phenomenology, and I'm going to read some quotes, and they're a little bit lengthy, but I think they'll help us understand, and they're from people who are much more eloquent than I am, and have thought about these things longer and harder than I have. And the first is Michael Polanyi, who's a phenomenologist, and he talks about he details like the process of hitting a nail with a hammer, and this is what he says. When I use a hammer to drive a nail, I attend to both, but quite differently. I watch the effects of my strokes on the nail as I wield the hammer. I do not feel that its handle has struck my palm, but that its head has struck the nail. I know the feeling in the palm of my hand by relying on them for attending to the hammer hitting the nail. So he talks later about using a stick as a probe in the dark, and maybe this will be an easier example to understand, where your attention is not in like where you're holding the stick, it's at the end of the stick. It's where the stick touches a wall, it's where the stick touches something. If you haven't hammered a nail in, or if you haven't probed in the darkness with a stick lately, we can think about what it's like to drive our cars. We can think about how our consciousness is emerges from interacting with this machine. This is really evident in the language we use to talk about it, right? That person hit me, that person in front of me, you know, and we identify with the car, we identify with the cars in front of us, not just the people. And I think nonetheless, these phenomenologists, they often think that we're extending the human brain into the object that we're using. This is something Deleuze and Guattari also talk about. We're extending our own consciousness into the object. But there's also something else there, right? There's the object. It's giving us something. We're not just giving something to it. I'm going to read, this is a lengthy quote, but I think it's beautiful, and it's by a guy named David Abram. He wrote a book called The Spell of the Sensuous, which is about animism and how language has... how language has affected us and made us lose our sense of animism in a way. So he eloquently explores this realm between bodies and perception, between two bodies and how perception arises from those two things. In the physical sense, so the realm that's inside of us, the realm that's behind us that we can't perceive because we're not looking in that direction, and the realm between two things, as well as in the phenomenological sense. So this is a lengthy quote, but where is this empathic contact taking place? Am I slipping out through my eyes and plunging across the valley to meet and feel the pleasure in those needles of a tree? He's talking about looking at a tree. Or is there some tree force pouring out from the branches and striding through the thickness of the air to meet and join my body here where I am staring? At any rate, somewhere between those trees and my body, and perhaps every point between us, there's contact and a kind of blending. And this simple instance of perception, this momentary meeting across the expanse of the valley, cannot help but be influenced by the mood of that medium between us, encouraged or obscured by the many happenings within that invisible depth, by its local turbulences and eddies, by condensation and warm updrafts in the cool, pellucid calms that briefly open or close within the unseen river of air as it rolls between my body and the breathing hillside. It's difficult to locate what consciousness is and talk about what animism is because we're so used to talking about consciousness being something that's located just within us. So we have these people who are so-called experts on consciousness. Daniel Dennett, John Searle, I don't know if you are all familiar with these people who, this is the new theory of consciousness, is that it doesn't exist. This is science's official explanation right now, is that well, we can't find it anywhere, so it doesn't actually exist, it's just an illusion. This is the actual official theory right now, which sounds like complete bullshit to me, right? Because, I mean, it seems pretty real to me. So, anyway. So I've just been talking about how consciousness and animism are really related, and how we can understand one by understanding the other. And how a different understanding of consciousness might reinvigorate our sense of animism. Jeanette Armstrong, who is a Native American philosopher and activist and writer, she says that the refusal to accept the world as alive, the refusal to have relationships with the world, she says, and a lot of other people have echoed this, she says that's the primary difference between more egalitarian indigenous cultures and our own, and Western culture. It's the primary difference. It's not incidental. It's the foundational difference.
Sorry, I just stepped there. Could you just repeat the primary difference again?
Yeah, animism. Yeah. So, we can't begin to understand how these more egalitarian societies functioned or do function if we're only looking at the people and their behavior, the human beings and their behavior, because in those societies, things that aren't human are considered people, are considered part of the society, are considered part of that culture. And once we cut that off and only look at people, we're not really actually understanding these cultures. We have to be inclusive of every member of the culture, even if it's a stone, even if it's a relationship between a person and a stone. This is a theory that's, or an idea, or an observation put forth by an anthropologist called Irving Hollowell. He's a really brilliant guy and just says you can't have an ethnography of a people if you're not looking at all the people in that society. So if we want to learn something from societies that have or had a way of life that was more egalitarian than our own, we have to look at the whole society.
What was the last name? Holloway?
Hallowell, yeah. So how is this anarchism, right? A lot of indigenous belief systems are really resistant to colonization and really resistant to statehood. There are hundreds and hundreds of stories of missionaries going into indigenous populations and trying to convert the Cheyenne is a really great example, the Cheyenne to Christianity. And so they did convert the Shine to Christianity, and then the Shine would go to church, and then after they left, the minister would be like, oh, what, so where are you going? And they'd be like, oh, yeah, we're going to practice our rituals, right? So even after, and this was really befuddled, the missionaries, even after there was a conversion or this extra thing added on, the mythic understanding of the world, which is founded on animism, was resistant, right? So I think we should look to traditions that actively resist colonization and statehood. People who cry romanticization at this, or when anyone brings up something indigenous that is, you know, seen as mystical or superior to our own culture, I think that we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. There are things that, I mean, I feel even nervous saying this in this company, but there are things about these cultures that are, there are mystical to us, maybe not to them, but to us they seem mystical. And there are things about these cultures that, frankly, I would say are superior to our own culture. And I think that sometimes this idea of romanticization has its merits, but it's often taken too far. And I think very often it's used as a tool of the state, of the oppressor, to say, and of the authority to say, well, yeah, well, these societies, you might think that they're better than ours, or you might think that this animism or this mythic way of thinking is kind of great, but you're just romanticizing. I mean, I don't think it's appropriate to do that in all cases. Another way that this is related to anarchism, besides this resistance to statehood, besides something, a foundation that creates a resistance to statehood, is that, did anybody go to the animals panel yesterday morning? No? Well, they talked a lot about just how, you know, exploitation of animals, and I would also say exploitation of plants, exploitation of the land base, is reflected in and leads into exploitation of people, that it turns into human-to-human violence after a while. There's a lot of work that's been done on that, and I'm not going to really talk about that much, but I think it's interesting. There's so much information on that that I don't find it necessary to go over it right now. But also, animistic perception begins to level the playing field and rein in technology, which is a real tool of the state and a real tool of corporations, technology is. Animists can have an understanding of the world that isn't a simple place where people can just create a conscious computer, but something as active, as changing, as moody as weather isn't alive, doesn't have its own. So if you want to understand how to have a conversation with a flower, all right, I'm gonna maybe walk you guys. Not like I have conversations with flowers all the time, but I think I have a better understanding of how to do it now than I did before I started investigating these things. You have to have a deep understanding of the thing in the natural world. I'm sorry I'm making distinctions between the natural and human world, but just allow me for a to have a deep understanding to have that communication. So you can't go up to a flower and be like, what's up? Like, what are you doing here? How do you work? Like, let me take you apart. I want to see how everything. You actually have to, you have to go up to it and present it with a more open question, which immediately starts from the place of recognizing it's alive. You can go up to something in nature and say, who are you? This changes everything a lot. The flower's not going to answer you in English, right? I mean, it might in your dreams, and it might at a certain point. There are plenty of instances of people in other cultures reporting being talked to by plants or being talked to by animals in the language that they speak. But I think for us, at least at this point, it's not going to answer us in English. But the flower does have a vocabulary in its form, in its morphology, in its gestures. We can learn things about what the flower is feeling, how the environment around it is doing, because a flower is an expression. Plants especially are a real expression of the environment that they're embedded in. So, and the really interesting thing is that, so the flower talks to us through form, and we understand that through English words in our head. So these two languages come together. This is where I talk about, you know, two things coming together and something emerging. These two languages come together, and an understanding emerges from those two languages coming together. our own language of symbols and abstractions, a flower's language of form. Something Goethe said, who Goethe, you know, is well known as a poet and a fiction writer, but he was also a scientist, and first and foremost, he considered himself a scientist. And he studied botany and made some really major discoveries. And something Goethe says is that you can't just go out to a flower and sit there and look at it. Even if you look at it 100 times, you don't get to jump to conclusions. You don't get to make any assumptions about the flower. The conclusions will emerge with your interaction between you and the flower, and they'll emerge over time. So imagine what this understanding does. Imagine if this is how we approach the natural world, what it would do to us as people. I think that a deep practice of real understanding doesn't allow for the same kind of violence that you can practice without understanding. Furthermore, I don't think this interaction, I think this interaction destabilizes hierarchy, since everything we perceive is an interaction. It's not one-sided. If we just have a one-sided analytical approach to everything, that is dominance in a way. If we approach everything, I was just talking about this with Jack last night. Analysis in some traditions, the symbol for that is the sword, right? And it's really interesting. The sword, you can see where this comes from, right? You can pierce something with a sword to see what's inside of it, but then you've killed it, right? So that kind of analysis and that kind of, I always want to figure things out instead of letting things come through understanding, I think it is a domination-based way to perceive the world. And so, you know, another, and for me, one of the most important aspects of how animism can lead to anarchism is that if you see the world as active, the living world is, you see the world as living and its other non-human beings as something that are living, we begin to see that the world is actually our greatest and most powerful ally against the state. Because it's always battling the state. The physical world is always battling things that are erected by abstraction and violence. So where I live in Amherst, there's this mine, the Davis Mine. And this mine has been, you know, all these metals have been taken out of it, and there's a river that runs by the mine. It's so polluted. And something really, really amazing has happened there, where outside the mine, with no human interruption or anything, these algal mats have grown up just on their own. You have no idea where they came from. So these algal mats are in this river. If you test the water in the river, near the algal mats, it's completely pure, whereas all the water at other points is polluted. So the world, you know, I mean, we can also think about this in terms of, like, if you pave a street, the street that leads people to work, that leads people to their factory jobs, the terrible conditions, their schools, their prisons, leave that for a month, and grass will start to grow out of it. Roots will start to break up the cement, ice heaves, weather will begin to disrupt that road. You know, I sometimes feel like if we forget that the world itself is the greatest environmentalist or the greatest enemy against the state, it's sort of like thinking that the American peace movement is what was responsible for ending the Vietnam War. Like, not the people in Vietnam who were doing something active and, like, fighting all the time, right? There's an active thing going on with the world. And when we begin to start to see that it's not passive, and we begin to have, you know, a different relationship with it, we can start to see where the state is weak by following where the world points us to. And joining in that, seeing these places as something Terek Jensen calls them fulcrums. We can see them as the places where we can join in the battle and help break the dams or break up the streets. I mean, after all, this is what the situationists wanted to do, right? Smash up the streets beneath the paving stones, the beach, right? Right, the tree is doing that all the time with its roots. So is the ice, so is the grass seed, the weeds. They don't need hammers, they just need patience, and they'll do it for us. Well, they won't do it for us all the time because we'll just keep dating them over, but they'll help us. So I think, you know, to conclude, I think as anarchists, we understand our relationship, or we at least have a better understanding than many other people of our relationship to the state, to domination, to hierarchy. So maybe we can take some time to reconsider our relationship to that which is not the state, the things that are not actually dominated by hierarchy, the things that don't express the same kind of hierarchy. I know this is a big debate. We talked about this in a workshop or talk before. You know, well, there is hierarchy in nature, some people said, and I'd be happy to answer questions like that. I don't think it's true. I think there's status and roles in nature, and I don't think it's the same thing as hierarchy. But let's take time to reconsider our relationship to that which is not the state and does not obey the state. And then, you know, we can begin to build our communities and the rest of the world in that community, and then we'll really begin to cause some trouble for the state because we have its most powerful enemy on our side. And that's all. Thank you.